Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Miro, and I will be your host for today's show. We have a very special guest with us today, and it is the author of Madison Avenue Manslaughter, Michael Farmer. How are you today, Michael?
Miro, nice to speak with you. I'm just fine.
Great, fantastic, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. I know that it's quite early where you are, so we really do appreciate it.
Not that early, but it's a beautiful spring day, so I'm happy to be up speaking with you.
Yes, and thank you very much. And for our audience to give some information about Michael, not only is he the author of the bestseller Madison Avenue Manslaughter, but prior to founding Farmer & Company in 1992, Michael was a strategy consultant with the Boston Consulting Group and a director of Bain & Company. He previously headed Bain's Munich, Paris and London offices during Bain's decade of European expansion in the 1980s. And what a list of amazing accomplishments, Michael.
I had a wonderful time in Europe, Miro. Bain was a very young firm, only a couple hundred people. And at the time, I think we only had 30 people in London when I first moved over. So we saw amazing expansion. It was a lot of fun running the Munich office when we had 9 people and the Paris office when we had 0 people. And then later I spent, a decade and a half in the UK. So I know London very well and absolutely love the city.
And which one would you say is your favorite out of the three?
Well, I think I have to give a tip to Paris because it was a very special time in my life. My daughter was born there. We started an office from scratch competing against the Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey, and we were quite successful. So it was a wonderful time, and of course, I'm a real Francophile in any case. Love the language and the food and the city. So I'd give Paris a nod, I think, among all the cities in the world, although I love London for what it offers and New York as well. They're just quite different from one another.
Yes, absolutely. And so I say, let's just get into the podcast for today. And we've been talking about this in the office, about Madison Avenue Manslaughter, and what an absolute success it's been. And for our audience, for those who have not encountered the book, and you absolutely should, it talks about the advertising industry and how it has reached a critical, even dangerous point in its development, and how agencies can, you know, destroy themselves by doing increased work for declining fees and so forth. So, Michael, my first question for you would be, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I had been consulting to ad agencies since the early 90s. And as time went on, 90 to 95 to 2000, 2005, etc., I was watching an industry that was going through some of the most momentous changes that were having an adverse effect on their profits and their operations, and I should think on employee satisfaction as well. And I was trying to help my clients solve that particular problem, but it seemed to me that management was in a state of denial about how bad things were, and that the subject about the momentous changes in the industry and what management needed to do to fix it was a bigger story than my consulting practice. So I decided to write the book and talk about what I think is one of the most interesting strategic stories in any industry that I've seen in my, fairly long consulting career.
Yeah, and I think what sticks out for me personally is the title itself. It is Madison Avenue Manslaughter. What is the meaning, behind the word manslaughter? It's a very powerful word. It's a word that has a lot of impact, and I think audiences are really attracted to it in that way.
Well, the use of manslaughter is because there is the possibility of a death and an accidental one. there are three major players in the industry as far as the ad agencies are concerned. There's the agency itself and the way it views itself, its successes in the past, the way it made money, its influence in the economy, the identification that senior people have with the glory days of the 60s and the 70s, etc. So there's the ad agency itself. Secondly, there are the owners of the ad agencies, because they were so successful in the, you know, 60s, 70s, etc., that they were snapped up by some very large holding companies, WPP in particular, with the largest holding company in the industry, which is based in the UK, Publicis Group, which is in France, Interpublic Group in the US, and Omnicom in the US, among others, bought up all the ad agencies, and of course, their expectation is growing profits. And then the third players are the clients for whom the advertising is done, and there are two players within the client. They're the marketing people that commission the work, and they're the procurement people who pay the fees. And among all of those different players, agencies are experiencing growing workloads, that comes from marketing at their clients, declining fees by the procurement people, and profit-hungry owners, the WPPs and others that expect very healthy and growing margins. And in order to deal with the growing workloads, declining fees, agencies have been downsizing. And so they've been juniorizing their people, to make up a word, and they've been cutting salaries, cutting headcounts in order to deliver profits to the holding company. And at a time when workloads are growing and becoming much more complex because of social and digital media, to be trying to do that work with fewer, more junior people is akin to liquidating your capabilities. So I see agencies sort of trapped where they're having to do more complicated work for less money and deliver growing profits, and accomplishing all that by downsizing. That's a recipe for a future death. No one wants it. No one expects it. No one thinks that they're a part of it, but that's what's going to happen.
Right. And to me, you know, it makes absolute perfect sense as someone who works within the digital sphere. And I think there was a very good saying that when it comes to a service, you know, it can be cheap, it can be good, and it can be fast, but you can only choose two out of the three. You can't have everything. And I think what you're saying resonates with me personally, and I think it makes perfect sense. And it leads me into my next question, Michael, and that would be, so you listed a couple of reasons to why this is happening, but do you think that there's any one particular reason or perhaps a point that kind of stands out from the rest and you think is the most important one?
Yes, because the notion that workloads is growing is something that I know. Because when I do my consulting to ad agencies, I have to measure what they're doing. I have to gather all the documentation I can about their clients. And over time, you know, over the last 25 years or so, working with my clients, I can see that their workloads have been growing at about a 2.5 to 3% compounded rate, which doesn't sound like a lot. But it doesn't take many years at that rate for the workloads to double. Now, here's the problem with agencies. They do not measure their workloads. Agencies are used to doing whatever the client wants for whatever fee is being paid. That's part of the tradition of the industry. So they don't measure their workloads, and they therefore don't use workloads to negotiate their fees. So in a way, they are accepting the client's statement of what they're prepared to pay, and then as the work shows up on the agency's doorstep, month by month, they just do it, and they don't realize that that they've got a growing workload problem. They know they have a declining fee problem, but they don't really know, because they don't measure it, the growing workload problem. And therefore, they do a very poor job negotiating or even talking to the clients about the effect of growing workloads and declining fees. So I've been critical of agencies for thinking that they can continue to do whatever the client wants for whatever fee the client is prepared to pay and have no ammunition to back up a different point of view, because they just don't keep track of their workloads. They don't have a way of measuring workloads, and therefore they're willing to accept declining fees every year.
Right, right. And without, you know, giving up too much about the book itself, for the future, do you perhaps have any tips on how agencies can move away from this business model and how they can sort of avoid the madman approach that they've been going for?
Well, I think in the book, I suggest that there are two very important things that agencies need to do. One is that the top management has to come to grips with a growing workload problem. They have to start measuring workload. They have to hold their senior account executives responsible for the agreements that they make with their clients. Right now, the senior account people who run the various clients are pretty much free to make any kind of commitment, like, sure, we'll do that work.
Right, yes.
You don't have to pay us anymore because we're good team players, et cetera, et cetera. And so around the agency network, you've got way too many people making freelance decisions, so to speak, on behalf of the agency without top management really knowing and without the folks being held accountable for it. So I'd say number one, chief executives have come to grips with the workload problem. The second thing is, it's almost a separate subject, but agencies have always been very proud of their creativity, the kind of creativity that won them awards over the years, and they continue to position themselves as, we're creative, that's why we're good, that's why you hire us. However, there was a change of client interest. In about the 90s, clients started to assert that the purpose of their corporation was to increase shareholder value, by that meaning returns to shareholders through principally increased stock prices. And so clients are out looking for people that can help them generate improved results. And because agencies haven't signed on to that as their purpose, it's one of the reasons that procurement is cutting their fees every year, because they say, well, we're not going to pay a lot of money for creativity. We can get it from anybody. So we view that as almost a commodity service. What we will pay a lot of money for are people that generate growing profits for us, like the management consulting firms. So I've asserted that one of the reasons that the fees are declining is because agencies don't view their mission as helping clients grow, gain market share, and increase shareholder value, and that they've got to steal a page from the management consultants whose only purpose is to generate improved results. That's how agencies will halt the fee declines and earn better fees. And then if they come to grips with the workload problem, then maybe they can look at growing fees for growing workloads at a higher rate because they're helping their clients generate improved performance.
Okay, and you touched upon briefly on creativity and how agencies kind of put it at the forefront of what makes them special and what makes them stand out. Do you think that perhaps that might be because of an oversaturation of the market for agencies and simply there was a point where there were too many of them?
Well, there are too many today. There's no question about the fact that the marketplace is crowded. There's overcapacity. It's a buyer's market. And when procurement, who took over the fee setting about 25 years ago, when they see a saturated market and they know that they have their choice of choice of agencies to work with, then they're very aggressive on price. But I think the creativity thing is actually not a differentiator among agencies, because if you have every agency in the marketplace saying, we're creative, it's not really very credible.
Right.
Now, certainly, there are certain agencies that consistently win more creative awards than others, like BBDO and Ogilvy and others like that. But I think clients are a little cynical about the winning of creative awards because it's the industry, and particularly ad agencies, awarding the awards to themselves at the Cannes, Advertising Festival of Creativity. So it's not really an objective measure. It's not a measure of ongoing creative differentiation. Furthermore, I think that the creativity argument has echoes in the 60s, when that was a period called the golden age of advertising, because television was the dominant advertising medium, at least in North America, not until later in the UK. But television was always considered the gold standard of creativity, the 30-second TV ad. It's also true that agencies made their most money there. And so when agencies say we're creative, what they're really saying or hearkening back to is we are really good at doing 30-second TV ads.
Right.
And we've won a lot of awards for that. And that kind of creativity, too, is a little out of date, because what clients are looking for today are digital and social solutions that generate improved shareholder performance, and that requires a different kind of creativity.
Right, yes, and this leads me on to my next question, actually. And that is that the internet, you know, the net 2.0 has, I think, undoubtedly changed the landscape of many different businesses, many different sectors, and perhaps played an important part within the downfall of ad agencies. So do you think that, you know, social media, online and digital advertising has played its fair share in the way that this medium has shifted?
Oh, absolutely. And it's also a contributing factor to Madison Avenue's manslaughter. Bear in mind, let's go back to a time, and you only have to go back about 10 years, to when the internet and digital advertising was very, very new. If you go back before then, if you go back to the early 2000s and in the 1990s, there was almost no digital advertising, and so television advertising still was the gold standard. And agencies who specialized in television advertising, like Ogilvy, J. Walter Thompson, TBWA, BBDO, Gray Worldwide, you know, name any agency, the agencies that are known for the television advertising and the creativity they showed back then, pre-internet. When the internet came along, they looked at the internet and they said, well, that requires software programmers. I mean, that's not our business.
Yes.
And so they were very reluctant to take on the new skills and the new kinds of people that they needed. They kind of looked down their nose at it, frankly, and they thought, let people create digital agencies with software people. And maybe we can work with them in partnership or something. But what they do, that's not our cup of tea. And so things evolved year after year after year. You had a large number of digital agencies get created, along with the direct marketing agencies that were never, never the type of work that the traditional agencies did. And what that has turned into is now a media landscape which is very fragmented. You have traditional agencies, you've got direct marketing agencies, you have sales promotion agencies, social agencies, and digital agencies. And because clients want all of those skills, they no longer work with a single agency as they did in the old days. You know, in the good old golden days, when it was mostly TV advertising, clients had what was called the agency of record. And there was a single agency that, you know, was a strategic partner and did all the work, etc. But now clients have 20 to 50 agencies, and no agency is king. And that means that the clients have taken over the running of the relationship. They decide what work is going to get done, who they're going to give it to. So they do the strategic work. They do what's called scope of work planning. They determine the fees. And the agency's voice has significantly diminished in the eyes of the client. And that's another contributing factor to the decline of fees. So I would say that the growth of social and digital media has led to an increase in the number of agencies who serve clients and the diminished voice of any one of those agencies in the marketing affairs of the clients. And that is another contributing factor to Madison Avenue's manslaughter.
Right. And I can imagine that as we have all these different types of, you know, digital agencies, as you mentioned, and the fact that it is very much the customer and the buyer's market, that in a way creates the same workload problem that you mentioned, because, you know, they set up the rules, you know, they say what they want, and because there's so many agencies, they simply have to do it. They have to keep up.
That's right. They've lost power. Agency relationships are very short these days. You know,
yes.
The day of the 40-year relationship is gone. In fact, in my consulting career, I've watched agency relationships decline from 15 years on average to 7 years on average to 4 years on average. It's about 2 to 3 years today, because clients are not satisfied with the quality of the services they're getting. There's a lot of choice out there, and procurement changes agencies all the time. It's one of the ways of driving fees down. So it is a very fraught marketplace. Agencies are terrified they're going to lose clients, and they will do anything that the client asks. Another contributing factor, because where I have been giving advice to certain agencies, they'd say, Michael, that's terrific advice you're giving. But frankly, you know, I think that if we start to get tough with the clients over the amount of work we're doing, they're just going to get rid of us and bring someone else on. So out of that fear, nobody is doing anything. And when I say nobody, I mean agency chief executives. And as a result, you have an entire industry that has subjected itself to growing workloads, declining fees, and profit-hungry owners, and a destruction or self-destruction of their capabilities. Where can that possibly end up other than seeing a major agency fail in the next couple of years and have to get merged with another agency within the holding company? I think we're very close to that. There are a number of big agencies that are really struggling. They're shrinking in size. They're shrinking in profits. They're not winning new business in the marketplace. It's only a matter of time, I think, unfortunately, because I think there's a lot that could be done about it.
Yeah, and one thing that actually stuck out for me that you mentioned is the fact that so many of these agencies actually have a lot of junior talent within them, and they are given quite a lot of responsibility, and it may come across that, you know, the senior account executives and the people that should be in charge, as a matter of fact, are not. And when perhaps the more junior member of staffs have been given all these creative projects or whatever it may be, sometimes they just can't deliver it, and then the client simply walks away.
Well, that's exactly the case. I think there's been a serious decline in the quality of agency work. Why not? I mean, you know, agencies are trying to do twice as much work with the fewer, more junior people that they've got. That isn't a recipe for quality work. The people that get downsized and are out on the street, so to speak, including some very good senior people, are setting up small agencies. And those small agencies are competing in a different way. So I think that what we're going to see is a resurgence of the agency business from small, privately owned agencies that are much more strategic. That's one thing. Another trend is that management consultancies are getting into the business. Deloitte Consulting, you know, well-known former, you know, accounting firm that does a lot of systems consulting, has bought 11 agencies and now has over $1.5 billion in digital advertising revenue. McKinsey has bought a design firm. Accenture has bought digital agencies. IBM has turned into a very powerful competitor for digital work, competing against Ogilvy, BBDO, Gray, Saatchi & Saatchi, etc. So there's a whole new competitive set, small agencies, management consulting firms, and let's not overlook the advertisers themselves that have set up internal agencies because they're dissatisfied with what they're getting from the agencies that they've worked with. So not only is there Madison Avenue's manslaughter for the larger holding company agencies, but there's an incredibly complicated competitive mix out there today.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And this leads on to our last question, actually. And although it might be a bit unrelated to what we've been talking about, we do ask all of the guests on the podcast, and that would be, what are you currently reading?
Oh, I'm reading a biography of Beethoven right now. I'm reading a novel called The Underwriting by Michelle Miller, who is a former employee of mine.
Right,
a wonderful employee who was an English major from Stanford. She did fabulous work as one of my consultants. She went off to Stanford and got an MBA, and then did work for J.P. Morgan for a while. But her real love was writing, and so she quit all her jobs and wrote a novel called The Underwriting, which has sold exceptionally well and is being turned into a TV series. So I feel very paternalistic about Michelle's novel. So The Underwriting, quite a good book. This very heavy-duty biography of Beethoven is another thing I'm reading because, you know, in my spare time, I take piano lessons and struggle with piano.
Right. Wow. Absolutely fascinating. And with that, I would like to thank you very much, Michael, for taking the time to be on the Lid Radio podcast. And to our audience, if you would like to find more about Madison Avenue manslaughter, you can by visiting lidpublishing.com and as well www.madisonavenuemanslaughterbook.com. And if you'd like to know more about Michael himself, you can find him on social media and as well at farmerandcole.com. And as well, Lid Publishing can be found on all forms of social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, at simply Lid Publishing. And again, thank you very much, Michael, for joining us today.
Miro, thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. And to our audience, thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Lid Radio.